Down the river a ways, he could see P sitting on a rangy bay they called Sardine. Of the hostile vaqueros they had met, there was no sign. There were so many questions Newt wanted to ask about what they had done and where they had been that he hardly knew where to begin. Yet, when he rode up to the captain, keeping Mouse far enough away from the hell bitch that she wouldn't try to take a bite out of him, he didn't ask any questions. They would have poured out of him if it had been Mr. Gus or Dietz or P, but since it was the captain, the questions just stayed inside. All he said, at the end of the most exciting and important night of his life, was a simple good morning. "It is a good one, ain't it?" Carl said, as he watched the huge herd of horses, well over 100 of them, pour over the low banks and spread out down the river to drink. P had ridden Sardine into the water stirrup deep to keep the herd from spreading too far south. Carl knew it had been rare luck, running into the 4 Mexican horse thieves and getting most of the horses they had just brought over from Texas. The Mexicans had thought that they had run into an army. Who but an army would have so many horses? And had not really stayed to make a fight. Though he had to scare off one vaquero who kept trying to turn the herd. As for the boy, it was good that he had picked up a little experience and come through it all with nothing worse than a dirty face. They sat together silently as the top half of the sun shot long ribbons of light across the brown river and the drinking horses, some of whom lay down in the shallows and rolled themselves in the cooling mud. When the herd began to move in twos and threes up the north bank, Carl touched the mare and he and the boy moved out into the water. Carl loosened his rein and let the mare drink. He was as pleased with her as he was with the catch. She was sure-footed as a cat and far from used up, though the boy's mount was so done in he would be worthless for a week. P's big bay was not much better. Carl let the mare drink all she wanted before gathering his rein. Most of the horses had moved to the north bank, and the sun had finished lifting itself clear of the horizon. "Let's ease on home," he said to the boy. "I hope Wilberger's got his pockets full of money. We've got horses to sell."
Chapter 12.
If Wilberger was impressed at the sight of so many horses, he gave no sign of it. The small herd had already been penned, and he and Dietz and a man called Chick were quietly separating out horses with a Hick brand on them. Dish Boget worked the gate between the two corrals, letting Wilberger's horses run through and waving his rope in the face of those he didn't claim. Jake Spoon was nowhere in sight, nor was there any sign of Augustus or the Irishman. The new herd was far too large to pen. Carl had always meant to fence a holding pasture for just such an eventuality, but he had never gotten around to it. In the immediate case, it didn't matter greatly. The horses were tired from their long run and could be left to graze and rest. After breakfast, he would send the boy out to watch him. Wilberger paused from his work for a moment to look at the stream of horses trotting past, then went back to his cutting, which was almost done. Since there was already enough help in the pen, there was nothing for Newt to do but stand by the fence and watch. P had already climbed up on what they called the Opry seat, the top rail of the corral, to watch the proceedings. His bay and Newt's mouse, just unsaddled, took a few steps and then lay down and rolled themselves in the dust. Carl was not quite ready to rest the mare when Wilberger finished his sorting and came over to the fence. It was her, not the captain, that he had his eye on. "Good morning," he said. "Let's trade. You keep them 38 splendid horses I just sorted out, and I'll take that mean creature you're astraddle of. 38 for one is generous terms in my book."
"You keep your book," Carl said, not surprised at the offer. P.I. was so startled by what he was hearing that he almost fell off the fence.
"You mean you'd give up all them horses for a chance of having a hunk bit out of you?" he asked. He knew men fancied the captain's mare, but anyone that would fancy her to that extent was almost more than he could credit. Dish Boget walked over, slapping the dust off his chaps with a coiled rope.
"Is that your last word on the subject?" Wilberger asked. "I'm offering 38 for one. You won't get a chance like that every day of your life."
Dish snorted. He fancied the gray mare himself.
"It'd be like trading $50 gold piece for 38 nickels," he said.
He was in a foul temper anyway. The minute they had the horses penned, Jake Spoon had unsaddled and walked straight to the dry bean as if that were where he lived. Wilburger ignored him, too.
"This outfit is full of opinion," he said. "If opinions was money, you'd all be rich," he looked at Call.
"I won't trade this mare," Call said. "And that ain't an opinion."
"No, it's more like damn hard fact," Wilburger said. "Now, I live on a horse, and yet I ain't had but good ones my whole life."
"This is my third," Call said. Wilburger nodded.
"Well, sir, I'm obliged to you for getting here on time. It's plain the man you deal with knows where there's a den of thieves."
"A big den," Call said.
"Well, let's go, Chick. We won't get home unless we start."
"You might as well stay for breakfast," Call said. "A couple of more of your horses are on their way."
"What are they doing, traveling on three legs?" Wilburger asked.
"They're with Mr. McCrae," Call said. "He travels at his own pace."
"Talk said it, too. I don't think we'll wait. Keep them two horses for your trouble."
"We brought in some nice stock," Call said. "You're welcome to look it over if you're still short."
"Not interested. You won't rent pigs, and you won't trade me that mare, so I might as well be on my way."
Then he turned to Dish Bogat.
"Want a job, son? You look all right to me."
"I got a job," Dish said.
"Running off Mexican horses isn't a job," Wilburger said. "It's merely a gamble. You've the look of a cowboy, and I'm about to start up the trail with 3,000 head."
"So are we," Carl said, amused that a man would try to hire a hand out from under him with him sitting there.
"Going where?" Wilburger asked.
"Going to Montana," Carl said.
"I wouldn't," Wilburger said. He rode over to the gate and leaned over to open it and rode out, leaving the gate for Chick to close.
When Chick tried to lean down and shut the gate, his hat fell off. Nobody walked over to pick it up for him either, and he was forced to dismount, which embarrassed him greatly. Wilburger waited, but he looked impatient.
"Well, maybe we'll see up the trail then," he said to Call. "I wouldn't aim for Montana, though. Too far, too cold. Full of bears, and I don't know about the Indians. They may be beat, but I wouldn't count on it. You might end up making some a present of a fine herd of beef."
"We'll try not to," Carl said. Wilburger rode off, Chick following at the rear of the small horse herd. As Chick rode past, Dish Bogat was greatly tempted to rope him off his horse and box his ears as a means of relieving his feelings about Laurie and Jake Spoon, but the captain was sitting there, so he merely gave Chick a hard stare and let him go. "By gosh, I could eat," P.I. said. "I sure hope Gus ain't lost. If he's lost, I don't know what we'll do for biscuits," he added, since nobody commented on his remark.
"You could always get married," Dish observed dryly. "There's plenty of women who can make biscuits."
It was not the first time P had had that particular truth pointed out to him.
"I know there is," he said. "But that don't mean there's one of 'em that would have me."
Dietz gave a rich chuckle.
"Why, the old Widow Cole would have you," he said. "She'd be pleased to have you."
Then, well aware that the Widow Cole was something of a sore spot with P, he walked off toward the house. Mention of Mary Cole made P.I. very uncomfortable. From time to time, throughout his life, it had been pointed out to him that he might marry. Gus McCrae was very fond of pointing it out, in fact. But once in a while, even if nobody mentioned one, the thought of a woman entered his head all on its own. And once it came, it usually tended to stay for several hours, filling his noggin like a cloud of gnats. Of course, a cloud of gnats was nothing in comparison to a cloud of Gulf Coast mosquitoes, so the thought of women was not that bothersome, but it was a thought P would rather not have in his head. He had never known what to think about women, and still didn't. But so far as actions went, he was content to take his cue from the captain, whose cue was plain. The captain left them strictly alone, and had all the years P had been with him, excepting only one puzzling instance that had occurred years before, which P only remembered once every year or two, usually when he was dreaming. He had gone down to the saloon to get an axe someone had borrowed and not returned, and while he was getting the axe, he heard a young woman crying out words and grievances to someone who was with her in her room. The woman doing the crying was the whore named Maggie, Newt's mother, whom Jake Spoon took such a fancy to later. It was only after P had found the axe and was already halfway home with it that it occurred to him that Maggie had been talking to the captain, and had even called him by his first name, which P had never used in all his years of service. The knowledge that the captain was in the room with a whore struck P hard, sort of like the bullet that had hit him just behind the shoulder blades in the big Indian scrape up by Fort Phantom Hill. When the bullet hit, he felt a solid whack and then sort of went numb in the brain. It was the same with the notion that struck him as he was carrying the axe home from the saloon. Maggie was talking to the captain in the privacy of her room, whereas, so far as he knew, no one had ever heard of the captain doing more than occasionally tipping his hat to a lady if he met one in the street. Overhearing that snatch of conversation was an accident P was slow to forget. For a month or two after it happened, he went around feeling nervous, expecting life to change in some bold way, and yet nothing changed at all. They all soon went up the river to try and catch some bandits raiding out of Chihuahua, and the captain, as far as he could tell, was the same old captain. By the time they came back, Maggie had had her child, and soon after, Jake Spoon moved in with her for a while. Then he left, and Maggie died. Gus went down one day and got Newt from the Mexican family that had taken him upon Maggie's death. The years had gone on passing, most of them slow years, particularly after they quit rangering and went into the horse and cattle business. The only real result of overhearing the conversation was that P was cautious from then on about who he let borrow the axe. He liked life slow and didn't want any more mysteries or sharp surprises. Though he was content to stick with the captain and Gus and do his daily work, he found that the problem of women was one that didn't entirely go away. The question of marriage, about which Dietz felt so free to chuckle, was a persistent one. Gus, who had been married twice and who had whored whenever he could find a whore, was the main reason it was so persistent. Marriage was one of Gus's favorite subjects. When he got to talking about it, the captain usually took his rifle and went for a walk. But by that time, P would usually be comfortable on the porch and a little sleepy with liquor, so he was the one to get the full benefit of Gus's opinions, one of which was that P was just going to waste by not marrying the Widow Cole. The fact that P had only spoken to Mary Cole 5 or 6 times in his life, most of them times when she was still married to Josh Cole, didn't mean a thing to a bystander like Gus, or even a bystander like Dietz. Both of them seemed to take it for granted that Mary regarded him as a fit successor to Josh. The thing that seemed to clinch it, in their view, was that while Mary was an unusually tall woman, she was not as tall as P. She had been a good foot taller than Josh Cole, a mild fellow who had been in Pickle's Gap buying a milk cow when a bad storm hit. A bolt of lightning fried both Josh and his horse. The milk cow had only been singed, but it still affected her milk. Mary Cole never remarried, but in Gus's view, that was only because P.I. had not had the enterprise to walk down the street and ask her. "Why, Josh was just a half pint," Gus said frequently. "That woman needs a full pint. It'd be a blessing for her to have a man around who could reach the top shelf." P. had never considered that height might be a factor in relations such as marriage. After brooding about it for several months, it occurred to him that Gus was tall, too, educated as well. "Hell, you're tall," he said one night. "You ought to marry her yourself. The both of you can read." He knew Mary could read because he had been in church once or twice when the preacher had asked her to read the Psalms. She had a kind of low, scratchy voice, unusual in a woman. Once or twice, listening to it made P feel funny, as if someone was tickling the little hairs at the back of his neck. Gus vehemently denied that he would be a suitable mate for Mary Cole. "Why, no, P. It wouldn't do," he said. "I've done been rung through the ringer of marriage twice. What a widow wants is someone fresh. It's what all women want, widows or not. If a man's got experience, it's bound to be that he got it with another woman. That don't never sit well. A forthright woman like Mary probably considers that she can give you all the experience you're ever likely to need.
To P, it was all just a troublesome puzzle. He could not remember how the subject had come up in the first place, since he had never said a word about wanting to marry. Whatever else it meant leaving the captain. P didn't plan to do that. Of course, Mary didn't live very far away, but the captain always liked to have his men handy in case something came up sudden. There was no knowing what the captain would think if he were to try and marry. One day he pointed out to Gus that he was far from being the only available man in Lonesome Dove. Xavier Wands was available, not to mention Lippy. A number of the traveling men who passed through were surely unmarried. But when he raised the point, Gus just ignored him. Some nights, laying on the porch, he felt a fool for even thinking about such things. And yet think he did. He had lived with men his whole life, rangering and working. During his whole adult life, he couldn't recollect spending 10 minutes alone with a woman. He was better acquainted with Gus's pigs than he was with Mary Cole, and more comfortable with them, too. A sensible thing would be to ignore Gus and Dietz and think about things that had some bearing on his day's work, like how to keep his old boot from rubbing a corn on his left big toe. An army mule had tromped the toe 10 years before. Since then, it had stuck out slightly in the wrong direction, just enough to make his boot rub a corn. The only solution to the problem was to cut holes in his boot, which worked fine in dry weather but had its disadvantages when it was wet and cold. Gus had offered to re-break the toe and set it properly, but P didn't hate the corn that bad. It did seem to him that it was only common sense that the sore toe made more difference in his life than a woman he had barely spoken to, yet his mind didn't see it that way. There were nights when he lay on the porch too sleepy to shave his corn, or even to worry about the problem, when the widow Cole would pop up to the surface of his consciousness like a turtle on the surface of a pond. At such times he would pretend to be asleep, for Gus was so sly he could practically read minds, and would surely tease him if he figured out what he was thinking about Mary and her scratchy voice. Even more persistent than the thought of her reading the Psalms was another memory. One day he had been passing her house when a little thunderstorm swept through the town, scaring the dogs and cats and rolling tumbleweeds down the middle of the street. Mary had hung a washing and was out in her backyard trying to get it in before the rain struck. But the thunderstorm proved too quick for her. Big drops of rain began to splatter in the dust, and the wind got higher, causing the sheets on Mary's clothesline to flap so hard they popped like guns. P had been raised to be helpful, and since it was obvious that Mary was going to have a hard time with the sheets, he started over to offer his assistance. But the storm had a start on both of them, and before he even got there, the rain began to pour down, turning the white dust brown. Most women would have seen at that point that the wash was a lost cause and run for the house, but Mary wasn't running. Her skirt was already so wet it was plastered to her legs, but she was still struggling with one of the flapping sheets. In the struggle, 2 or 3 small garments that she had already gathered up blew out of her hand and across the yard, which had begun to look like a shallow lake. P hurried to retrieve the garments and then help Mary get the wet sheet off the line. She was evidently just doing it out of pure stubbornness, since the sun was shining brightly to the west of the storm and would obviously be available to dry the sheet again in a few minutes. It was P's one close exposure to an aspect of womankind that Gus was always talking about, their penchant for flying directly in the face of reason. Mary was as wet on the top as on the bottom, and the flapping sheet had knocked one of the combs out of her hair, causing it to come loose. The wash was as wet as it had been before she hung it up in the first place, and yet she wasn't quitting. She was taking clothes off the line that would just have to be hung back on in 15 minutes, and P was helping her do it as if it all made some sense. While he was steadying the clothesline, he happened to notice something that gave him almost as hard a jolt as the bolt of lightning that had killed Josh Cole. The clothes he had rescued were undergarments, white bloomers of the sort that it was obvious Mary was wearing beneath the skirt that was so wet against her legs. P was so shocked that he almost dropped the underpants back in the mud. She was bound to think it bold that he would pick up her undergarments like that.
Yet she was determined to have the sheets off the line, and all he could do was stand there numb with embarrassment. It was a blessing that the rain soon began to pour off his hat brim in streams right in front of his face, making a little waterfall for him to hide behind until the ordeal ended. With the water running off his hat, he only caught blurred glimpses of what was going on. He could not judge to what extent Mary had been shocked by his helpful but thoughtless act. To his surprise, nothing terrible happened. When she finally had the sheet under control, Mary took the bloomers from him as casually as if they were handkerchiefs or table napkins or something. To his vast surprise, she seemed to be rather amused at the sight of him standing there with a stream of water pouring off his hat and falling just in front of his nose. "P, it's a good thing you know how to keep your mouth shut," she said. "If you opened it right now, you'd probably drown. Many thanks for your help." She was the kind of forthright woman who called men by their first names, and she was known to salt her speech rather freely with criticism. "We've the Lord to thank for this bath," she said. "I personally didn't need it, but I'm bound to say it might work an improvement where you're concerned. You ain't as bad-looking as I thought, now that you're nearly clean." By the time she got to her back porch, the rain was slacking, and the sun was already striking little rainbows through the sparkle of drops that still fell. P had walked on home, the water dripping more slowly from his hat. He never mentioned the incident to anyone, knowing it would mean unmerciful teasing if it ever got out, but he remembered it. When he lay on the porch half-drunk, it floated up in his mind. Things got mixed into the memory that he hadn't even known he was noticing, such as the smell of Mary's wet flesh. He hadn't meant to smell her. He hadn't made any effort to. And yet the very night after it happened, the first thing he remembered was that Mary had smelled different from any other wet thing he had ever smelled. He could not find a word for what was different about Mary's smell. Maybe it was just that, being a woman. She smelled cleaner than most of the wet creatures he came in contact with. It had been more than a year since the rainstorm, and yet Mary's smell was still part of the memory of it. He also remembered how she seemed to bulge out of her corset at the top and the bottom both. It was not every night that he remembered Mary, though. Much of the time he found himself wondering about the generalities of marriage. The principal aspect he worried over most was that marriage required men and women to live together. He had tried many times to envision how it would be to be alone at night under the same roof with a woman, or to have one there at breakfast and supper. What kind of talk would a woman expect? What kind of behavior? It stumped him. He couldn't even make a guess. Once in a while it occurred to him that he could tell Mary he would like to marry her, but didn't consider himself worthy to live under the same roof with her. If he put it right, she might take a liberal attitude and allow him to continue to live down the street with the boys, that being what he was used to. He would plan, of course, to make himself available for chores when she required him. Otherwise, life could go on in its accustomed way. He was even tempted to sound out Gus on the plan. Gus knew more things about marriage than anyone else. But every time he planned to bring it up, he either got sleepy first or decided at the last second he'd better keep quiet. If the plan was ridiculous in the eyes of an expert, then P wouldn't know what to think. And besides, Gus would never let up teasing. They were all scattered around the table, finishing one of Bowles' greasy breakfasts, when they heard the sound of horses in the yard. The next minute, Augustus trotted up and dismounted with the two Irishmen a few yards behind him. Instead of being bareback, the Irishmen were riding big silver-studded Mexican saddles and driving 8 or 10 skinny horses before them. When they reached the porch, they just sat on their horses, looking unhappy. Dish Boget had not really believed that there were any Irishmen down in Mexico, and when he stepped out on the back porch and saw them, he burst right out laughing. Newt felt a little sorry for the two of them. But he had had to admit they were a comical sight. The Mexican saddles were all clearly meant for men with longer legs. Their feet did not come anywhere near the stirrups. Even so, the Irishman seemed disinclined to dismount. Augustus jerked the saddle off his tired horse and turned him loose to graze. "Get down, boys," he said to the Irishman. You're safe now as long as you don't eat the cooking. This is what we'll call home.
Alan O'Brien had both hands around the big Mexican saddle horn. He had been holding onto it so tightly for the last 2 hours that he was not sure he could turn it loose. He looked down with apprehension.
I had not realized how much taller a horse is than a mule, he said. Seems a long ways down.
Dish regarded the remark as the most comical he had ever heard. It had never occurred to him that there would be such a thing as a grown man who didn't know how to dismount from a horse. The sight of the two Irishmen stuck with their short legs dangling down the sides of the horses struck him as so funny that he doubled over with laughter.
I guess we'll just have to build him a ladder, by God, he said when he could catch his breath.
Augustus, too, was mildly amused by the Irishman's ignorance.
Well, boys, you just have to flop over and drop, he said.
Alan O'Brien accomplished the dismounting with no real trouble, but Sean was reluctant to drop once he flopped over. He hung from the saddle horn for several seconds, which puzzled the horse so that it began to try and buck a little. It was too thin and too tired to do much, but Sean did get jerked around a little, a sight so funny that even Call laughed. Alan O'Brien, once safe on the ground, immediately joined the laughter out of relief. Sean finally dropped and stood glaring at his brother.
"Well, I don't see Jake, that figures," Augustus said,
taking himself a big dipper of water and swishing a few mouthfuls around and spitting them out to clear the dust from his throat. He then offered the dipper to Alan O'Brien, who imitated the swishing and spitting, thinking it must be a custom of the new country he found himself in.
"You took your time, I see," Call said. "I was about to start back with a burial party." "Shucks! Bringing these boys in was such a light task, I went over to Sabinas and stopped off at the whorehouse."
"That explains the saddles," Call said.
"Yes, and the horses, too. All the bandits was dead drunk by the time we got there. These Irish boys can't maintain much of a pace riding bareback, so we helped ourselves to a few saddles and the best of the nags."
"Them horses wouldn't make good soap," Dish said, looking at the horses Augustus had brought back.
"If I wasn't so hungry, I'd argue the point," Augustus said. "Buy all them horses for a week or two, and they'll produce a fine soap."
Young Sean O'Brien could not conceal his disappointment with America. "If this is America, where's the snow?" he asked, to everyone's surprise. His image of the new country had been strongly influenced by a scene of Boston Harbor in winter that he had seen in an old magazine. There had been lots of snow, and the hot backyard he found himself in was nothing like what he had expected. Instead of ships with tall masts, there was just a low adobe house, with lots of old saddles and pieces of rotting harnesses piled under a little shed at one corner. Worse still, he could not see a spot of green anywhere. The bushes were gray and thorny, and there were no trees at all.
"No, son, you overshot the snow. What we have down here is sand."
Call felt his impatience rising. The night had been far more successful than he could have hoped. They could keep the best horses and sell the rest. The profits would easily enable them to hire a crew and outfit a wagon for the trip north. Then all they would have to do would be to gather the cattle and brand them. If everyone would work like they should, it could all be accomplished in 3 weeks. They could be on the trail by the 1st of April, none too soon, considering the distance they had to go. The problem would be getting everyone to work like they should. Jake was already off with his whore, and Augustus hadn't had breakfast. "You men go eat," Call said to the Irishman. Having rescued them, he could do no less than feed them. Alan O'Brien was looking dejectedly at the few buildings that made up Lonesome Dove.
"Is this all there is to town?" he asked.
"Yes, and it's worse than it looks," Augustus said.
To the embarrassment of everyone, Sean O'Brien began to cry. It had been an extremely tense night, and he hadn't expected to survive it. All during the ride, he had expected to fall off his horse and become paralyzed. He associated paralysis with falls because a cousin of his had fallen off a cottage he was thatching and had been paralyzed ever since. The horse Sean had been given seemed to him at least as tall as a cottage, and he felt he had good reason to worry. He had spent a long boat ride growing more and more homesick for the green land he had left. When they were put ashore at Veracruz, he had not been too disappointed.
It was only Mexico they were in, and no one had ever told him Mexico was green. But now they were in America, and all he could see was dust and low bushes with thorns and almost no grass at all. He had expected coolness and dew and green grass on which to stretch out for a long nap. The bare hot yard was a cruel letdown, and besides, Sean was an easy weeper. Tears ran out of his eyes whenever he thought of anything sad. His brother Alan was so embarrassed by the sight of Sean's tears that he walked straight into the house and sat down at the table. They had been asked to eat, and if Sean preferred to stand in the yard crying, that was his problem. Dish concluded that the young Irishman was probably crazy. Only someone crazy would break out crying in front of several grown men. Augustus saved the day by going over and taking Sean by the arm. He spoke kindly to him and led him toward the house.
"Let's go eat, son," he said. "It won't look quite so ugly on a full stomach."
"But where's the grass?" Sean asked, snuffling.
Dish Boget let out a whoop. "I guess he was meaning to graze," he said. "Why, no, Dish," Augustus said. "He was just reared in a place where the grass covers the ground, not in no desert like you."
"I was reared on the Matagorda," Dish said. "We got grass knee-high over there."
"Gus, we need to talk a minute," Call said. But Augustus had already led the boy through the door, and Call had followed him in.
A surprised Bolivar watched the Irishman put away sow belly and beans. He was so startled by their appearance that he picked up a shotgun that he kept by the cook stove and put it across his lap. It was his goat gun, a rusty 10-gauge, and he liked to have it handy if anything unusual happened.
"I hope you don't decide to shoot that thing off in here," Augustus said. "It'd take a wall out if you did, not to mention us."
"I don't shoot yet," Bull said sullenly, keeping his options open. Call waited until Augustus filled his plate, since there would be no getting his attention till he had food before him. The young Irish boy had stopped crying and was putting away beans faster even than Augustus. Starvation was probably all that was wrong with him.
"I'm going to see if I can hire some hands," Call said. "You better move them horses this afternoon."
"Move 'em where?" Augustus asked.
"Upriver, as far as you want," Call said.
"These Irishmen have fine voices," Augustus remarked. "It's a pity there ain't two more of 'em. We'd have a barbershop quartet."
"It would be a pity if you lost them horses while I'm off hiring hands, too," Call pointed out.
"Oh, you mean you want me to sleep out on the ground for several nights just to keep Pedro from stealing these horses back? I'm out of practice sleeping on the ground."
"What was you planning to sleep on the way to Montana?" Call asked in turn. "We can't take the house with us. There ain't many hotels between here and there."
"I hadn't been planning on going to Montana," Augustus said. "That's your plan. I may come if I feel like it. Or you may change your mind. I know you never have changed your mind about anything yet, but there's a first time for everything."
"You'd argue with a stump," Call said. "You just watch them horses. We may never get that lucky again."
Call saw there was no point in losing any more time. If Augustus was not of a mind to be serious, nothing could move him.
"Jake did come back, didn't he?" Augustus asked.
"His horse is here," Call said. "I guess he probably come with it. You think he'll work once we start?"
"No, and I won't either," Augustus said. "You better hire these Irish boys while you got the chance."
"That's work we're looking for," Alan said. "What we don't know, we'll gladly learn."
Call refrained from comment. Men who didn't know how to get on and off a horse would not be much use around a cow outfit.
"Where are you going hiring?" Augustus asked.
"I might go to the Rainies," Call said. "Many boys as they got, they ought to be able to spare a few."
"I sparked Maud Rainey once upon a time," Augustus said, tilting back in his chair. "If we hadn't had the Comanches to worry with, I'd expect I'd have married her. Her name was Grove before she was married. She lays them boys like hens lay eggs, don't she?"
Call left to keep from having to talk all day. Deets was catching a short nap on the back porch, but he sat up when Call came out.
Dishbo Gett and the boy were roping low bushes, Dish teaching the boy a thing or two about the craft of roping. That was good, since nobody around the Hat Creek outfit could rope well enough to teach him anything. Call himself could rope in an emergency, and so could P, but neither of them were ropers of the first class. "Practice up, boys," he said. "Soon as we gather some cattle, there's going to be a pile of roping to do." Then he caught his second-best horse, a sorrel gelding called Sunup, and headed northeast toward the brush country.
Chapter 13
Lorena had stopped expecting ever to be surprised, least of all by a man, and then Jake Spoon walked in the door and surprised her. The surprise started the minute before he even spoke to her. Partly it was because he seemed to know her the minute he saw her. She had been sitting at a table expecting Dish Boget to come back with another $2 he had borrowed somewhere. It was an expectation that brought her no pleasure. It was clear Dish expected something altogether different from what the $2 would buy him. That was why, in general, she preferred older men to younger ones. The older ones were more likely to be content with what they paid for. The younger ones almost always got in love with her and expected it to make a difference. It got so she never said a word to the young men, thinking that the less she said, the less they would expect. Of course, they went right on expecting, but at least it saved her having to talk. She could tell Dish Boget was going to pester her as long as he could afford to, and when she heard boot heels and the jingle of spurs on the porch, she assumed it was him, coming back for a second round. Instead, Jake had walked in. Lippy gave a whoop and shook Jake's hand. Jake was polite and glad to see them, and took the trouble to ask their health and make a few jokes, but even before he had drunk the free drink, he had begun to make a difference in the way she felt. He had big muddy brown eyes and a neat mustache that turned down at the corners. But of course she had seen big eyes and mustaches before. What made the difference was that Jake was so at home and relaxed even after he saw her sitting there. Most men got nervous when they saw her, aware that their wives wouldn't like them being in the same room with her, or else made nervous by the thought of what they wanted from her, which they couldn't get without some awkward formalities of a sort that few of them could handle smoothly. But Jake was the opposite of nervous. Before he even spoke to her, he smiled at her several times in a most relaxed way. Not in the bragging way Tinkersley had when he smiled. Tinkersley's smile had said plainly enough that he felt she ought to be grateful for a chance to do whatever he wanted her to do. Of course, she was grateful to him for taking her away from Mosby and the smoke pots, but once she had been away for a while, she came to hate Tinkersley's smile. Lorena felt puzzled for a moment. She didn't ignore the men who walked through the door of the Dry Bean. It didn't do to ignore men. The majority of them were harmless, with nothing worse than a low capacity to irritate. They were worse than chiggers, but not as bad as bedbugs, in her view. Still, there was no doubt that there were some mean ones who plain had it in for women, and it was best to try and spot those and take precautions. But as far as trusting the general run of men, there was no need, since she had no intention of ever expecting anything from one of them again. She didn't object to sitting in on a card game once in a while. She even enjoyed it, since making money at cards was considerably easier and more fun than doing it the other way. But a good game of cards once in a while was about as far as her expectations went. Immediately, Jake Spoon began to change the way her thinking worked. Before he even brought his bottle to the table to sit with her, she began to want him to. If he had taken the bottle and gone to sit by himself, she would have felt disappointed, but of course he didn't. He sat down and asked her if she'd like some refreshments and looked right in her face for a while in a friendly, easygoing way. "My goodness," he said, "I never expected to find nobody like you here. We didn't see much beauty when I lived in these parts. Now, if this was San Francisco, I wouldn't be so surprised. I reckon that's where you really belong." It seemed a miracle to Lori that a man had walked in who could figure that out so quick. In the last year, she had begun to doubt her own ability to get to San Francisco, and even to doubt that it was as cool and nice as she had been imagining it to be.
And yet she didn't want to give up the notion, because she had no other notion to put in its place. It might be silly even to think about it, but it was the best she had. Then Jake came along and right away mentioned exactly the right place. Before the afternoon was over, she laid aside her caution and her silence and told Jake more about herself than she had ever told anyone. Jake said very little, though he patted her hand from time to time and poured her a drink when her glass was empty. Once in a while he would say, "My goodness," or, "That damn dog. I ought to go find him and shoot him." But mostly he just looked friendly and confident, sitting there with his hat tipped back. When she got through with her story, he explained that he had killed a dentist in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and was a wanted man, but that he had had hopes of eluding the law, and if he did, he would certainly try to see that she got to San Francisco, where she belonged. The way he said it made a big impression on Lori. A sad tone came into his voice from time to time, as if it pained him to have to remember that mortality could prevent him from doing her such a favor. He sounded like he expected to die, and probably soon. It wasn't a whine, either. Just a low note off his tongue and a look in his eye. It didn't interrupt for a minute his ability to enjoy the immediate pleasures of life. It gave Lori the shivers when Jake talked like that, and made her feel that she wanted to play a part in keeping him alive. She was used to men thinking they needed her desperately just because they wanted to get their carrots in her, or wanted her to be their girl for a few days or weeks. But Jake wasn't asking for anything like that. He just let her see that he felt rather impermanent and might not be able to carry out all that he wished. Lorena wanted to help him. She was surprised, but the feeling was too strong to deny. She didn't understand it, but she felt it. She knew she had a force inside her, but her practice had been to save it entirely for herself. Men were always hoping she would bestow some of it on them, but she never had. Then, with little hesitation, she began to offer it to Jake. He was a case. He didn't ask for help, but he knew how to welcome it. She was the one who suggested they go upstairs. On the way up, she noticed that Jake was favoring one foot. Turned out one of his ankles had been broken years before when a horse fell on him. The ankle was apt to swell if he had to ride hard for long stretches, as he had just done. She had helped him ease his boot off and got him some hot water and Epsom salts. After he had soaked his foot for a while, he looked amused, as if he had just thought of something pleasant. "You know, if there was a tub around here, I'd just have a bath and trim my mustache," he said. There was a wash tub sitting on the back porch. Lorena carried it up when she needed a bath and the 6 or 8 buckets of water it took to fill it. Lorena offered to get the wash tub since Jake had one boot off, but he wouldn't hear of it. He took the other boot off and limped down by himself and got the tub. Then he bribed Lippy to heat up some water. It took a while since the water had to be heated on a cook stove. "Why, Jake, you could buy a bath from the Mexican barber for 10 cents, Lippy pointed out. "That'd be true, but I prefer the company in this establishment," Jake said. Lorena thought that maybe he would want her to leave the room while he bathed, since so far he had treated her modestly, but he had nothing like that in mind. He latched her door so Lippy couldn't pop in and catch a glimpse of something it wasn't his business to see. "Lippy will eye the girls," Jake said. No news to Lorena. "I wished it was a bigger tub," he said. "We could have us a wash together." Lorena had never heard of such a thing. It surprised her how coolly Jake stripped off for his wash. Like all men who weren't pure gamblers, he was burned brown on his face, neck, and hands, and was fish white on the rest of his body. Most of her customers were brown to their collar and white below. The great majority of them were reluctant to show anything of their bodies, though it was bodies they had come to satisfy. Some wouldn't even unbuckle their belts. Lorena often made them wait while she undressed. If she didn't, whatever she was wearing got messed up. Also, she liked undressing in front of the men because it scared them. A few would get so scared that they had to back out of the whole business, though they always scrupulously paid her and apologized and made excuses. They came in thinking they wanted to persuade her out of her clothes, but when she matter-of-factly took them off, it often turned the tables. Gus was an exception, of course. He liked her naked, and he liked her clothes. Seeing one body would remind him of other bodies, and he would sit on the bed and scratch himself and talk about various aspects of women that only he would have had anything to say about. The varieties of bosoms, for example. Jake Spoon wasn't as talkative as Gus, but he was just as immodest. He sat happily in the tub until the water got cold. He even asked if she'd like to give him a haircut. She didn't mind trying, but quickly saw that she was making a mess of it and stopped with only a small portion of his curly black hair removed. Once he toweled himself off, he turned and led her to the bed. He stopped before he got there and looked as though he was going to offer her money. Lorena had wondered if he would, and when he stopped, she turned quickly so he could undo the long row of buttons down the back of her dress. She felt impatient, not for the act, but for Jake to go ahead and assume responsibility for her. She had never supposed that she would want such a thing from a man. But she was not bothered by the fact that she had changed her mind in the space of an hour, or that she was a little drunk when she changed it. She felt confident that Jake Spoon would get her out of Lonesome Dove, and she didn't intend to allow money to pass between them, or anything else that might cause him to leave without her. Jake immediately stepped over and helped her undo the buttons. It was plain she wasn't the first woman he had undressed, because he even knew how to unhook the dress at the neck, something most of her customers would never have thought of. "You've had this one a while, I reckon," he said, looking rather critically at the dress once he got it off her. That, too, surprised her, for no man had ever commented favorably or unfavorably upon her clothes, not even Tinkersley, who had given her money to buy the very dress Jake was holding, just a cheap cotton dress which was fraying at the collar. Lorena felt a touch of shame that a man would notice the fraying. She had often meant to make a new dress or two, that being the only way to get one in Lonesome Dove, but she was awkward with a needle and was still getting by on the dresses she had bought in San Antonio. In the months there, she had had several offers to go to San Antonio with men who would probably have bought her dresses, but she had always declined. San Antonio was in the wrong direction. She hadn't liked any of the men, and anyway, didn't really need new dresses, and she was attracting more business than she wanted just wearing the old ones. Jake's comment had been mildly made, but it threw Lorena slightly off. She realized he was a finicky man. She could not get away with being lazy about herself any longer. A man who noticed a frayed collar with a near-naked woman standing right in front of him was a new kind of a man to Lorena, one who would soon notice other things, some perhaps more serious than a collar. She felt disheartened. Some glow had seeped from the moment. Probably he had already been to San Francisco and seen finer women than her. Perhaps when it came time to leave, he wouldn't want to bother with someone so ill-dressed. Perhaps the surprise that had walked into her life would simply walk back out of it. Her sinking confidence was only momentary. Jake put the dress aside and watched her draw her shift off over her head, and he sat beside her when she lay down. He was perfectly at ease. "Well, Laura, you take the prize," he said. "I had not a hope of being this lucky when I headed back here. You're as fine as flowers." When he began to stroke her, she noticed that his hands were like a woman's, his fingers small and his fingernails clean. Tinkersley had had clean fingernails, but Jake wasn't arrogant like Tinkersley, and he gave the impression of having nothing but time. Most men crawled on top of her at once, but Jake just sat on the bed smiling at her. And when he smiled, her confidence returned. With most men, there was a moment when they moved their eyes away, but Jake kept looking at her right in the eye. He looked at her so long that she began to feel shy. She felt more naked than she had ever felt, but when he bent to kiss her, she flinched. She did not like kissing, but Jake merely grinned when she flinched, as if her shyness was funny. His breath was as clean as his hands. Many a sour breath had roughed her hair and affronted her nostrils, but Jake's was neither rank nor sour. It had a clean, cedary flavor to it.
When it was over, Jake took a nap, and instead of getting up and dressing, Lori lay with him, thinking. She thought of San Francisco, and just thinking about it made her think that she could do anything. She didn't even feel like moving to wipe the sheets. Let them be. She would be going soon. When Jake woke, he looked at her and grinned. His hand, warm now, went right back to work. "If I ain't careful, I'm apt to sprout up again," he said. Lorena wanted to ask him why his breath smelled like cedar, but she didn't know if she ought, since he had just come to town. But then she asked him, a little shocked at hearing her own voice make the question. "Why, I passed a cedar grove and cut myself some toothpicks," Jake said. "There's nothing that sweetens the breath like a cedar toothpick, unless it's mint. And a mint don't grow in these parts." Then he kissed her again, as if to make her a present of a sweet breath. Between kisses, he talked to her about San Francisco and what might be the best route to take, even after he slid between her legs again and made the old bedspring whine and the sorry mattress crackle, he kept talking a little. When he finally got up and stretched and suggested they go downstairs, Lorena felt more cheerful than she had for years. Xavier and Lippy, who were used to her long sulks, hardly knew what to think. Neither did Dish Bogat, who happened to walk in. Dish sat down and drank a bottle of whiskey before anybody noticed. Then he got to singing, and everybody laughed at him. Lorena laughed as loud as Lippy, whose lip waved like a flag when he was amused. Only later, when Jake left to ride south with Captain Call, did Lorena feel impatient. She wanted Jake to come back. The time with him had been so relaxed it almost seemed like a wakeful dream of some kind. She wanted to have the dream again. That night, when a skinny cowboy named Jasper Fant came in from the river and approached her, Lori just stared at him silently until he got embarrassed and backed off, never having actually said a word. Staring was all she had to do. Jasper consulted with Lippy, and by the end of the week, all the cowboys along the river knew that the only sporting woman in Lonesome Dove had abruptly given up the sport.
Chapter 14.
When Jake finally came ambling up to the house, having spent the better part of the day asleep in Lorena's bed, Augustus was already nuzzling his jug from time to time. He was sitting on the front porch, waving off flies and watching the two Irishmen, who were sleeping as if dead under the nearest wagon. They had gone to sleep in the wagon's meager shade. The shade had moved, but not the Irishman. The boy had no hat. He slept with his arm across his face. Jake didn't even glance at them as he walked past, a fact that Augustus noted. Jake had never been renowned for his interest in people, unless the people were whores. "Where's Call?" Jake asked when he got to the porch.
"You didn't expect to find Woodrow Call sitting in the shade, did you?" Augustus asked. "That man was born to work."
"Yes, and you was born to talk too much," Jake said. "I need to borrow $10.
"Oh," Augustus said. "Has Lori upped her rates?"
Jake ignored the question, which was only meant to rile him, and reached for the jug. "No, the girl's as generous as a preacher's widow," Jake said. "She wouldn't take money from a gentleman like me. I hope she charged you plenty, though, for I know you've been there before me."
"I've always tried to keep a step ahead of you, Jake," Augustus said. "But to answer your question, Carl's gone to round up a darn bunch of cowboys so we can head out for Montana with a darn bunch of cows and suffer for the rest of our lives."
"Well, darn," Jake said. "I admit I was a fool to mention it." He settled himself on the lower step and set the jug halfway between them so they could both reach it. He was mildly chagrined that Call had left before he could borrow the money. Extracting money from Augustus had always been a long and wearisome business. Call was easier when it came to money. He didn't like to lend it, but he would rather lend it than talk about it, whereas Augustus would rather talk than do anything. Also, it was bothersome that Call had seized on the idea of Montana so abruptly, though it had always been his view that if you could just hit Call with the right idea, he would apply his energies and make a fortune, which he might then share with a man who brought along the idea. Now that he was back, though, he wouldn't mind spending a few warm, idle months in Lonesome Dove. Laura was more of a beauty than he expected to find, Her room over the saloon wasn't much, but it was better accommodation than they could expect on the way to Montana. As usual, though, life moved faster than he had intended it to. Call would come back with a lot of cowboys, and he would practically have to marry Lori in order to get out of going up the trail. Then, even if he did set his foot down and stay in Lonesome Dove, who knew but what some lawman from Fort Smith would show up and drag him off to hang. Just as he had been in the mood to slow down, his own loose mouth had gotten him in trouble. "Maybe he won't find no cattle to drive, or no hands neither," he suggested, knowing it was wishful thinking.
"He'll find the cattle, and if he can't find the hands, he'll drive them himself. Make us help him."
Jake tipped his hat back and said nothing. The blue shoat wandered around a corner of the house and stood there looking at him, which for some reason Jake found peculiarly irritating. Gus and his pig were aggravating company. "I ought to shoot that pig right betwixt the eyes," he said, feeling more irritable the longer he sat. There was not much good in anything that he could see. Either it was back to Montana and probably get scalped, or stay in Texas and probably get hung. If he wasn't careful, the girl would get restless and actually expect him to take her to San Francisco. The main problem with women was that they were always wanting something like San Francisco, and once they began to expect it, they would get testy if it didn't happen. They didn't understand that he talked of pleasant things and faraway places just to create a happy prospect that they could look forward to for a while. It wasn't meant to really happen, and yet women never seemed to grasp that. He had been in ticklish spots several times, and their disappointment turned to anger. It was something how mad women could get. "Was you ever threatened by a woman, Gus?" he asked, thinking about it.
"No, not what you'd call threatened," Augustus said. "I was hit with a stove lid once or twice."
"Why?" Jake asked.
"Why, no reason," Augustus said. "If you live with Mexicans, you expect to eat beans sooner or later."
"Who said anything about Mexicans?" Jake said, a little exasperated. Gus was the derndest talker. Augustus chuckled.
"You was always slow to see the point, Jake," he said. "If you fool with women, you'll get hit by a stove lid sooner or later. Whereas if you live with Mexicans, you'll have to expect beans in your diet."
"I'd like to see the woman that can hit me with a stove lid," Jake said. "I will take an insult once in a while, but I'd be damned if I'd take that."
"Lori's apt to hit you with worse if you try to wiggle out of taking her to San Francisco," Augustus said,
delighted that an opportunity had arisen to catch Jake out so early in his visit. Jake let that one float. Of course, Gus would know all about the girl. Not that it took brains to know about women. They spread their secrets around like honey in a fly trap. Of course Lori would want to go to San Francisco. By common agreement, the prettiest town in the West. Augustus stood up and lifted his big pistol off the back of his chair.
"I guess we ought to wake up them Irishmen before they bake," he said.
He walked over and kicked at their feet for a while until they began to stir. Finally, Alan O'Brien sat up looking groggy.
"Lord, it's warm, ain't it?" he said. "Why, this is spring, son," Augustus remarked. "If you're looking for warm, come back on the 4th of July. We usually thaw out by then."
When he was sure both Irishmen were awake, he went back into the house and came out with his rifle.
"Well, let's go," he said to Jake.
"Go where?" Jake asked.
"I just got set down." "To hide them horses," Augustus said. "Pedro Flores is no quitter. He'll be coming."
Jake felt sour. He wished again that circumstances hadn't prompted him to come back. He had already spent one full night on horseback, and now the boys were expecting him to spend another, all on account of a bunch of livestock he had no interest in the first place. "I don't know as I'm coming," he said. "I just got here. If I'd known you boys did nothing but chouse horses around all night, I don't know that I would have come."
"Why, Jake, you lazy bean," Augustus said, and walked off.
Jake had a stubborn streak in him, and once it was activated, even Call could seldom do much with him. The Irish boy was standing up, trying to get the sleep out of his eyes.
"Come on, boys," Augustus said.
Time to ride the river.
Hey, you want us to ride some more? Sean asked. He had rolled over during his nap and had grass burrs in his shirt.
You'll soon catch on to riding, Augusta said. It's easier than you might think.
Oh, do you have any mules? Sean asked.